everybody. It's Wayne with Mark and Areeb, and we are so excited that you've come to watch the Eat Community Podcast. We know you're going to enjoy it. We actually did it live originally on our Eat Community webinar series, which we also invite you to come to, but you will love this podcast that you're going to be listening to right now.
Hey everyone, welcome to another session of our weekly webinar with Dr. Wayne Dorman. If you're hearing me, type in a one. If you can see my screen, I would just like to welcome everyone to this webinar. So how are you all doing? So everybody, we'll get started here in a second. If you're in the audience, type in a one into the chat area or question area. So I'd just like to welcome you all for a session with Dr. Wayne Dorman. He might be a little late today, but in the meantime, we will watch a replay from Mark Shepherd's Restoration Agriculture and Forest Ecology a series that he had a whole new series with us at the Eat Community. So a lot of you have already watched it. Those of you who didn't watch it, you can go back to our website and find Mark Shepherd's Restoration Agriculture series. But today, I will be showing you a replay one of his sessions, so just hold on tight. Might give a few minutes for people to come in. I know a bunch of you already here, so welcome everyone once again. This is a weekly podcast with Dr. Wayne Dorman that we hold here at the Eat Community. And those of you who are here, please type in a one if you're hearing me. And we'll get started here in a minute. And we'll just give a few minutes for people who are still logging in from our Eat Community. And people who are joining still on this session. So, I think we got a few minutes before we get started here. Once again, welcome for those who are joining. And we'll get started here in just a minute. So this is a replay. I'll show this in a minute.
To another session in Forest Ecology Exposition from a Restoration Agriculture perspective. And tonight we're going to use all of the things that we talked about in previous webinars cumulatively and now start to understand how we interact with our land with these different ecological understandings in mind. And so one of the things that we talked about earlier is that that the disturbance of a site, whether it's wind or water, landslides, all that kind of stuff, is what changes and moves this through time. Aside from just the passive growing of all these plants, there's active activity going on that's changing the site, and those activities are the disturbance. Of course, everything is from the perspective of how do we create a permanent agriculture? And my original inspiration for permanent agriculture, permaculture, if you will, is from Tree Crops, J. Russell Smith. Way massively inspired. My life, I guess, was changed when I read Bill Mollison and when I heard him say on a the Global Gardener video about permaculture design is that the aim is to create systems that are ecologically sound and economically profitable. And what I like about the ecologically sound and economically profitable, if it's ecologically sound, we can't screw up. Everything is recyclable. Everything is part of nature. If it's economically profitable, we can feed ourselves, pay our bills, have surplus to share, and to leverage for other good activities that we might want to do, earth-helping, healing activities. David Holmgren was Bill Mollison's sidekick at first, and he kind of codified what Bill Mollison had started in the Permaculture Designer's Manual. And these are some principles. So we enact our permaculture design on the planet by following these principles. And A, number one, the one I really harp on a lot, is observe and imitate and interact. We want to observe nature, imitate what works, and then interact with the system that we've created. And that's what understanding ecology is all about. All of the other principles below, from capture, store energy, obtain and yield, and so on, all of these other apply, but first and foremost is if we are not observing nature, imitating nature with our systems, and then interacting with that, we miss the whole point. So that's why we're going through this. And I'm going to bring this up again and again and again until everybody finally gets it. How I approach permaculture, how I approach agriculture, how I approach the production of all these different crops from pine nuts, apples, hazelnuts, chestnuts, produce, livestock is radically different than anyone else who has an orchard or a cattle herd or a, you know, pig operation, whatever the situation is, a radically different approach. And if we're going to observe nature, we have to actually observe the reality of the phenomena and not just project our thoughts, our concepts, our ideas onto nature. And I want you guys just think for a little bit. If I take apple trees, and we'll see some pictures of this, and I plant a whole bunch of apple trees, and I mow the ground underneath it, maybe I'll even use some herbicide underneath so the herbicide strip with no weeds right under the trees. Maybe I'll stake the apple trees to hold them up, maybe put a deer fence around to keep the deer out. Here's my apple orchard. Now I spray, you know, X times a week for apple scab, for coddling moth, plum curculio, you know, all these bronze-headed borers and various different things. And at the end of the season, I harvest my apples. That's an apple orchard. Well, what actually is happening there, the observable phenomena is that the person plants these apple trees in the ground and does this herbicide and mows and does the fence. These are observable phenomena. Well, then nature does what nature does, and a coddling moth flies in and starts laying eggs on your apples. That's just reality. We observe reality. Well, what an orchardist is doing when they immediately see the coddling moth damage and immediately start spraying to fight against the coddling moth is there's this concept, this idea of what this orchard should be. It should be perfect, picture perfect, everything's fine and nothing ever bothers it. There's never any fungus, never any wind damage, never any insects, nothing. Well, as soon as something does come in, that's a problem, and you fight against it with inputs and expenses. That's a radically different approach than another person who does a restoration agriculture approach, plants a whole bunch of apple trees, puts them out in a row, and maybe, and since he knows that apples like a little bit of weed control, maybe they mow between the rows, or maybe they graze animals between the rows. Well, then when pests or diseases come in, they observe which ones get the pests, which ones don't get diseases. Is there a specific location that gets them more than others? Shut up, phone. I'm going to turn that off. Excuse me, everybody. So there's just a difference between the two. One is we're observing reality and interacting with it. The other one is wanting reality to be our idea, this orchard, picture-perfect orchard, and we do everything we can to defend this idea of what our orchard should be. The apple orchard, as conceptualized by people, is a very expensive way to produce apples, and we'll go into that later. I've got a big, long session tonight, so we want to make sure I fly through this pretty quick. Here's my book, Restoration Agriculture. Buy it. It's now being translated into Spanish. The video is going to be translated into Spanish soon, and we also have a person now that's going to be doing all of the YouTube videos that you see publicly online. Those are also going to be either overdubbed with Spanish or have you know, Spanish subtitles underneath. Now, forest ecology is the scientific study of the patterns, processes, the flora, the fauna of forested ecosystems. Now, forest ecosystems is a discrete land unit that we can kind of like figure out and we can understand and study all the plants, animals, microorganisms, all of the non-living stuff, the parent material of the rock, how wet an area is. All these facts influence our study and influence our forested site. So we have our forest ecology is the study of this particular place as it changes through time. Now, succession is ecosystem change that occurs through a short period of time, decades to centuries. That's what we can see on a piece of property in our lifetime. What I've seen on New Forest Farm in 21 years is a successional process. One of the things about succession is that if we understand succession, we can know what the future is going to be. And people often ask me, it's like, wow, did you know that this was going to be like this 20-some-odd years ago? It's like, well, yeah, we planned it this way. Now, of course, we did the design, the water management design. We put the species in place and imitated the natural plant communities of our area. And then we've managed it as a farm ever since. So we knew what it was kind of going to behave like because we knew it was going to behave like an oak savanna. What we didn't know were the details. And it's those details that we have to accept the feedback from and learn how our management, our disturbance, affects our ecosystem as time goes on. But by understanding succession, we can know the future. And what helps to drive our successional pathway is disturbance. It's any kind of event in time that changes the ecosystem. Its structure, which is its shape, its physiognomy, the species composition, or how it functions. This picture right here, I've mentioned before that siltation, the covering of one area with eroded material from another area, it's a natural disturbance. This is actually a section of my farm that from all of the floods that occurred last night, all the rain that occurred last night, we had a raging river coming down the valley from the neighboring 100 acres, and it deposited a huge load of silt that it picked up from their cornfields and deposited across our lower, flatter spots. And we see erosion. So erosion and siltation, both of these have changed the structure of it. It's changed the actual shape of the land. We've eroded material here. We've deposited material here. This is an ecosystem disturbance. Disturbance can be at all different scales, from continental glacier-wide, glacier on a continental scale, mountains blowing up like Mount St. Helens, or it can be a single individual tree that blows over. Maybe not even fast, because I've seen places in river bottoms where everything is so super saturated that the wind blows and one tree just kind of slowly falls over and may even take a few days or weeks to finally finish falling over as it like slowly oozes out of the slot. Those are all ecosystem disturbances. So when some kind of disturbance occurs, flood, fire, disease, pest outbreak, whatever, it's important for us as restoration agriculture farmers and ranchers, it's important for us to understand how those systems recover from disturbance and what organisms are going to replace the ones that are destroyed, how they're going to replace them, what the time period is like. And if we look at this system right here, understanding that this place right here is not going to look like this 20 years from now. This place is not going to look like that 20 years from now. This place that had this massive outbreak of bark beetle, well, we don't know what actually caused the outbreak of bark beetle. It may have been some other previous environmental insult that weakened or damaged the trees. Sometimes it can be too much water. There's a lot of pines and spruces, for example, that want to have well-drained soil. If it's too wet, they'll get all kinds of root fungus. That weakens them. Then the bark beetle comes in. Well, this right here has undergone a disturbance event, massive bark beetle outbreak. What's the successional pathway that this is going to take? If we understand succession and we understand how disturbance works, we know what the future of this place is. We know what this will look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now. So disturbance affects the physical site by creating new landforms. All of this soil, this is close to 2 feet deep. This is, again, on my property, right? It's about 2 feet deep of topsoil that came from the neighbor's farm and got stuck behind a brush gabion that I built here in the middle of the valley. So we've got a new landform, new flat ground. It's probably pretty fertile soil if you don't mind all the hormones and antibiotics and cattle birth control pills and stuff. One of the things that I wanted to show with both of these silt deposition photos, this one included, is the fact that soil mixing to a certain degree is natural. It's normal. It's part of a natural way that soil, rich fertile soil, is created. That here, new raw mineral soil, crushed rocks, are deposited on top of these finer silts are in here, right on top of previously existing vegetation. That previously existing vegetation now starts to decompose. You've got new rock up here that's oxidizing. We now can go ahead and flood it again and bury it again. Now we have all these mixed layers of minerals and organic matter and decaying organic matter. So what we do is we're accelerating the process of creation of soil. So not all soil disturbance is detrimental to the creation of rich soil. Disturbance will change the light and the temperature regime of the site. Any of these trees that were ripped down no longer cast shade, so there's more light in there available for other plants. We now have new substrates available here for plants to get sprouted in. So by understanding how the disturbance works, what types of new conditions it provides us with, we can now select the proper response to this disturbance. How are we going to interact with this? Because now we know that nature has created for us new site conditions. How can we capitalize on this to create current short-term and long-term yields? All of these disturbances from light and temperatures, you know, sand dunes, deposits, sediments, all that, have long-term effects on the life of the area and even the hydrology of the region. Now, exclusion of disturbance is its own kind of disturbance. We've talked about this before, is that the exclusion of fire in fire-dependent systems is its own kind of disturbance. Something that was normal here way back in the early part of the 20th century, there's most of the redwoods were these open grassy parklands, same with Ponderosa. Much of the Intermountain, Great Basin, the Pacific Coast were open, gladed, savanna-type systems with these gigantic, large, wide-spaced, open-grown trees with grasses underneath, all kinds of wild animals there. Well, when we excluded the fire, which, you know, Europeans thought was, you know, totally damaging to the trees, and it does kind of damage to a certain extent, it was actually what was perpetuating the system and keeping the system the way it was. Whereas now with the trees with no fire, they get tall enough. If a fire happens to come through here, the fire can get so tall that it'll torch the tops of these trees, and these ones will die. It'll wipe the whole system out. Instead of just maintaining this system, it would destroy this whole system, and it'd start somewhere else in succession and go forward. So by understanding how these disturbances work and interact with the different species, we can predict to a certain extent what our system will look like, how productive it'll be in the future. Now, most communities don't start from scratch, for example. There are biological legacies. Wherever there's some sort of disturbance, there's some living things that are left behind. In this case, redwoods in the middle. These are like 20 or so redwoods in the middle of farm country in Northern California. These guys are now starting to reseed. You see a couple of them in here. When the conditions are right, they can continue to spread. So we've got a legacy to help move this forward. No matter where you are, most places, I can't say all places anymore because I know that there's some places that are really, really trashed. Almost all places have some sort of biological legacy, something living from the previous ecosystem that will now help to establish your new successional system and drive it in a particular direction. In some cases, you'll have these biological legacies not necessarily on your property, but outside of your property, dropping seed on you all the time. And so you're going to have to understand what they do by colonizing your site and somehow work with them to bring your site to the productivity that you're looking for. Some of the physical legacies left behind are like bare or rearranged mineral soil. So remember this, we have legacies left behind. We have bare or rearranged mineral soil for new seed beds, new microtopography. We have pits, we have mounds, there's debris flow, sedimentation, erosion, you'll see it. So these are the physical legacies left behind. These will also affect what we do in the future. New erosion gullies on the farm will tell you, okay, I got to deal with this somehow. First, let's try to prevent them before they happen. Well, if they happen, how did they happen? Why did they happen? Can we do a preventative measure? Now, how do we repair the damages that's there and actually help use these new exposed sites to propagate a new successional pathway? You know, the pit and mound, I once again show that naturally, totally normally, we're mixing the mineral soil with the organic matter. The organic matter is decomposing. We're creating a low spot for a little puddling of extra water here so those little young little seedlings don't dry out. And there's all this nice organic matter decomposing. The pit and the mound architecture is a common disturbance feature. And also in talking about animals, I talked mostly about grazing and trampling and browsing when the animals are eating the trees. I didn't talk much about what ground burrowing animals do. This is an example right here. This is actually a badger digging after a chipmunk. Badgers dig incredibly fast, and basically if a badger goes after you, you're doomed, and it'll just burrow into the ground and disappear in like 3 or 4 seconds. So chipmunks, in the first place, they made these tunnels in the ground, and they're bringing mineral soil back up and throwing it out at their doorstep. Badgers are going in, they're really churning it up. So here's some disturbance. We're mixing mineral soil with organic matter. That's helping to accelerate the creation of a rich, fertile topsoil. Well, and we're creating drainage. Now there's air that can go way deep into the soil profile, however deep the chipmunk or the badger went. Now there's oxygen down in there. We have an oxygenation or aerobic process going on. There's more life in an oxygenated environment, at least as far as we know. So here's mixing, aeration. Well, then, of course, when it rains, which I've got some pictures that will show, these now become the bathtub drains, and water goes down these holes deep into the soil strata, all through the network of tunnels, and it slowly soaks in. This is, I just had to take this picture because this is absolutely brilliant. This is a depression, and here's a box elder tree. Pay attention to this box elder tree because I'm going to take this one picture here, then we're going to go around the other side and take a picture there, and then stand here and take a picture here. That right there is a badger den. About 5 years ago, we had a family, or actually a pregnant mom, a badger moves in. She raised one young, 1 year, one, then two, and then one. So she's one, two, three, four, five kids she's had in the last 4 years. So what she's done is she's excavated this den. However, it's kind of located in a valley spot. So what she did is she also excavated all these tunnels here. And anytime any water collects on the down, you know, to the bottom part of this picture, it falls into her pre-dug tunnels, and it goes over here and down a bathtub drain that she made. So this thing can get like 2 feet of raging water roaring down in it, and that stays dry. And so then down the backside here, you can see all the debris that came down into her pre-excavated tunnels, and she's bringing it around this side of the tree. She dug these swales and berms, not me. This badger did it. And then you can see the debris flow here again. It goes around the front of it and right down this bathtub drain. So this slide here, this tunnel, or this excavation drains over here. That spot right there is where that final drain tunnel is. This is her cave, or her den, and this is the drain spot. So this drains over that spot, and then this drains over that spot. This comes this way, goes around front of the tree, and down that hole there. Her den is under here, perfectly dry. And I've seen this thing with raging 2 feet of water roaring down in these holes, and her spot is totally dry. So tunneling, this moving of debris, mixing of mineral soil with the organic matter is totally normal, it's totally natural. It's doing something. Let's understand what it's doing. Part of what it's doing that I really like with the water management strategy on my farm, you see how this grass is all laying this way, and then we've kind of got this piece of goldenrod that's kind of swirling, and you can just see a little bit of the pattern here, how this water, I wasn't there when the water was there, was swirling down this rodent hole. It's either a 13-line ground squirrel or some sort of vole or something that did this. This is especially exciting for me in the wintertime when we have frozen ground, and we have a rain on frozen ground late winter that happens quite commonly around here. There'll be water flowing in the system, catching in the swales, moving out towards the ridge, and all of a sudden you'll hear the bathtub drain, and I'll go looking for it and find it. And I went looking for the picture on my photo album here of the picture of the water going down the hole in the wintertime, and I couldn't find it. But most rodents that are tunneling in the ground, if they're going to be hibernating in the wintertime, they're not stupid. They dig their tunnels down below the frost line. So when the water flows across frozen ground, it's not soaking in. Then it goes down their tunnels, hits the thawed soil, and it soaks in down there. Here's another example. You can see how the water can even wash the grass right down into that little hole there. There's oodles of bathtub drains. Now, if I was putting rodent poison out to kill all these rodents in my quote-unquote orchard area, I wouldn't have the benefits of water infiltration, so I'd probably have to use drip irrigation to get the irrigation that I'm not getting because I'm letting all the water wash away. Goes in, must come out, This right at the top of the screen here is a rodent hole. Just look at all the sediment and debris that has come out. So here's more ecological disturbance. The material that was all green and wonderful here got buried with more silt and chunks of plastic and whatever else it is that was in that hole and got washed out. And just to show you a couple of things around, you can go online and look at all kinds of ridiculous pictures of animal tunnels. But in their tunnels, so these tunnels, now water's flying down in it. Well, some of these that are up like this and up like this, up like this, the water goes in, and now they're in an airlock chamber, and they're perfectly safe from all this flood water that now goes down into their other tunnels. And no doubt, as soon as the water starts flowing down the walls, they're like, honey, let's go up to the nursery and spend the night up there. So they go up there. I've never seen rodents getting washed out of their tunnels. So somehow they've got these little safety rooms in there that are airlocked up above the water. Now, what's really significant, how it relates directly to restoration agriculture, is human disturbance is a disturbance, still is. Like in the case of mining here, it may be a lot more devastating than some kind of natural disturbance. Arguably, this is no more disturbing than a volcanic eruption like Mount St. Helens. And what's even fascinating about this is even in serious mining operations, strip mine, mountaintop removal operations, there are still legacies left behind. Wind-blown seed still comes in and colonizes it. Fungi are somehow still able to colonize, and mycelium go all through this mess, even if it's toxic, believe it or not. There's life in there. There is some sort of legacy left behind here, and it is still going through succession into the future. All these different things, logging, mining, fire suppression, construction, settlement, clearing for agriculture, all of these are ecological disturbances. And if we remember that disturbance is an observable event in time that changes the structure, species composition, and the function of an ecosystem. Agriculture, how we get our food, is an ecological disturbance. This is I argue, a fairly massively disturbed site. This is corn in Iowa, as far as the eye can see. Whatever this was before, whether it was prairie or savanna, not likely that this site was forest. That ecosystem was destroyed. The soil was exposed, probably originally with mules and a plow. Nowadays, the ecosystem that wants to survive and grow there, beginning with weeds, begin the successional pathway back to some sort of stable, diverse ecological state. It's always arrested with herbicide or plowing. This is an ecological disturbance. Most of the species diversity is gone. It's kind of like all settled down to one, and that's Zia maize. Now, human beings have been getting food a whole bunch of different ways, and all of it involves some sort of ecological disturbance. And one of the most significant ones that we know worldwide, one of the most significant landscape shaper changers disturbances, is fire. Well, we happen to be the critter that really, really has embraced fire. We can use, once upon a time probably used it to scare prey animals. We've used it for cooking food. Proteins that were previously undigestible now become digestible. Food that has gone too far and it's a little bit dangerously rotten now becomes less rotten, and it's not as poisonous to us when we cook it. We can use it for scaring away the boogeymen at night, like these lions. We can use it for lighting our cave. We can use it for burning out in the bush to remove extra brush so dangerous things don't hide in the bushes and come after us. And it will foster grass growth so we can see our prey, which would be large grazing animals. And it's always also been used as ceremony, as fun, a way to bring people together. So fire, not only is it the most significant landscape disturbance, it's also one of the most significant things in our own life as human beings. We may not do these activities this way very much anymore. I haven't been hunting mammoth in a long time, but we still use fire in various shapes or form. All of our ignition combustion engines are based on fire. All of our electrical motors are a fire-type process. Fire is what drives our culture. So once upon a time, we were hunter-gatherers. Well, then somewhere along the line, slash-and-burn agriculture got started. Well, it didn't, got started and then just finished. It's been going on forever, as long as people have been doing slash-and-burn agriculture. This was taken this last February in Nsindi, Uganda. 10 years prior to when this picture was taken, this was a tall, They call it a high forest, a high monsoon tropical forest. There probably were chimpanzees, all kinds of wildlife out here in this high forest. Amazing diversity of plants and animals. Well, human beings come along, folks who practice slash and burn agriculture, they come along, they cut down all the trees. One of the biggest activities for this particular wave of humanity that's going into the forested areas, cut the trees down. Modern times in the U.S., it's all the loggers going in, cutting the trees down, and then the next wave of development or agriculture follows after that. Well, the first wave here in this part of Africa, the slash and burn people, they come in, they make charcoal, they sell the charcoal for money. Well, now they have money to buy food and clothes and cell phones and all that kind of stuff and get to town, buy some alcohol. All of a sudden, once all their trees are gone, they don't have any more charcoal, more trees to burn into charcoal, so they don't have any more income. They've always been growing a few little vegetables and stuff in the ground, but never enough really to feed them. They've been abusively grazing their animals. By abusively, I mean they're using it to continue to tear the forest down. So they begin to live poorer lives because they've degraded their resource base and they don't have any more cash income. So they move to the next phase and they do it again. They know, as a personal example, for real, and it's proven in their life, our life is better when we're destroying a forest and making charcoal to get money. They really experience that. They don't necessarily see the insidious agricultural consequences of being invaded now by annual agriculture. Here comes the big, flat, green, owned mostly by people who don't actually live there. These are fields that are either owned or leased by the UNI Sugar Company right here. And so by understanding succession, we know the future. We know that if you destroy the forest and expose the ground to plant annual crops, you depauperate the soil. The soil loses its organic matter. The soil food web shuts down. Nutrients don't cycle as much. Water doesn't infiltrate. You have bigger floods. Now plants don't grow as much. You don't hold as much water. Droughts are worsened. And so here we got right here. This is not corn. This is not Iowa. This is Uganda. This is sugar. As far as the eye can see, this is what was once upon a time, 10 years ago, this was high tropical monsoon forest. And this is what the people get to live on. These are their farms, like the size of most of our American homes is the size of a piece of land that families have to live on, and they have to raise all of their food or else starve. It's just really the way it is. So you wonder why people get violent when all of a sudden they don't have any food or clean drinking water or whatever. This is from an actual site that I worked on, where they had started to realize that if they make pits in the ground, at least a little bit of water would concentrate in those pits and they could get some crops established. They were growing mostly in this area, maize, a certain kind of bean, some lentils, and cassava is their staple food crops. Well, if you grow just maize on this ground and you get no rain when you need to have rain, you don't have any maize, your family starves, so you have to start, stealing or go to town or whatever it is. By destroying the original habitat and plowing the ground every single year with no regard to ecological realities, that is a continued catastrophic annual disturbance. Every year this gets plowed again, either with an ox or by hand tools. Same with in Iowa. Every single year they spray that ecosystem dead with herbicide and they start over again. That is a catastrophic reset button going all the way back to the very beginnings of succession. And this has always led to complete ecosystem destruction and the collapse of the societies that were dependent on those practices. The charcoal burners, subsistence gardeners, are destroying the very resource base that they need to stay alive. And it's actually by destroying the resource base, that's what keeps them alive. Well, let's look at ourselves. Look at our industrial culture. We're destroying forests worldwide extremely fast. We're depleting aquifers. We're poisoning aquifers. We're poisoning groundwater. We're fracking this. I mean, we are messing the system up as fast as we can. And, of course, because economic growth is what it's all about, right? Well, we can have economic growth. We can change the way we do things. Here's an example. This is an island off the coast of Greece. This particular island is Kea, I believe it is. There were once upon a time 150,000 people who lived on a rather small island. There were four separate nation states on the various different mountain forms. The whole thing was once upon a time. It was oaks, olives, chestnuts, pomegranate. If you want a fascinating read, go to the beginning of, I believe it's the Odyssey by Homer. He describes sailing by the coast. It could have been this coast right here. And he describes the most incredibly rich, luxuriant, abundant place, all these perennial trees and bushes and vines, all kinds of fruits and grapes and nuts. Well, then what happened, of course, is they began to, at least they made terraces. You can see all the terraces in the name. They would clear cut everything to plant wheat. This became one of the granaries of the Greek Empire back during its big golden era when Athens, rose to prominence. Then it, all of a sudden, there was...
Okay, I paused the video momentarily because I hear that Wayne is with us. Wayne, can you hear us?
Do you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yes.
Hello, Mark. Do you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Well, if you have video going, I need to plant. I'm on a road. I'm going to have to pull over here a second.
Okay.
Sort of make it easy whether we keep playing it or I'm going to be on until at the end. How long is it?
We're almost halfway done, but I can keep playing until you find a place suitable for talking. Then we can continue. Then
I'll be about 5 minutes, and I will be, and I'll text you. Then I'll text the whole group.
Oh, okay, all right. So I'll continue with the video.
Weren't enough people to work all the land, and so they had
all
to bring in slaves. So slaves would work the land, growing all the grain that fed the soldiers that marched on all the different, superhero movies and whatnot, and built all of these ridiculous temples. So now what's happened, look at Greece, it's probably one of the, it's one of the worst off economies in all of the European Union. One of the best things they got going for them is ruins. The previous, glorious civilization was there, fell apart because they destroyed their resource base. There are other futures possible, though, and we can know them. We can understand them. We don't have to, wish and hope that things are better. We know how ecosystems work. We know that if we collect a little water, soak it into the ground, we're going to have more moisture over a longer period of time available for plants, whether we're growing annual plants or perennial plants. We then know that if we plant trees, various different propagation techniques from cuttings, or these are shoots that grow off the side of a banana or from seed, we can actually grow these plants, and as they grow through time, they're going to start to cast a shade. This ground will be cooler because there will be a little bit of shade, which when it's cooler and there's some shade, it won't lose its water so much. It will start to grow through time. We'll use a little bit of mulch to hold in some of that moisture. And if we're planting all food trees, which these are right here, and if we're doing it in an alley-cropping system, we could still grow, our maize and our sweet potato or our cassava in the alley while we're growing our polyculture of tree species with water management involved. We know that we can choose a future. You can choose a future that looks like this. We can choose this future by continuing down the path of destroying our ecosystems to grow our food, or we can replant the ecosystems to grow our food. So these guys right here are replanting their ecosystems. These guys now all are living in the United States. I think he's a sophomore in high school in Tulsa, and he's a soccer superstar. Big, tall, lean, fast-running Tanzanian kid. So we can choose the future that we want to experience by planting it. And this is me in that exact same spot a mere 4 years later. Has it changed? Yes, it's changed. Did I know it was going to change? Of course I did. Did I realize that it was going to change this fast and be that rich and luxuriant? Wow, I didn't know the details, that's for sure. It was a delightful surprise. This is Farmer John. He's the guy who now runs a food cooperative or distribution cooperative. This site right here is on a school. You can see these are the dormitories for the kids who stay there in residence. This was a system designed to feed the kids that go to this school. Well, John lives in one of the small villages next door. He got a similar system started at his school. He owns a truck, which not very many people there owned a truck. And so all of the neighboring farmers, when the bananas are ripe, everybody's eating bananas as fast as they can, but there's extra. There really are extra. We've now created an abundance of certain foods. When the mangoes are ripe, the bananas are ripe, whatever it is in season, we try to schedule it so there's something ripe every season. They've got a little bit of surplus apiece. If I've got four extra mangoes, it's not going to do me any good. I can sit out by the side of the road and nobody's going to buy it. Or me and my neighbors all just pool together. We put them in boxes. We put them on John's truck. He takes them to town. He sells it. He comes back, distributes the money. Or actually, he picks up stuff on the way back from town. This is the same exact dog on site. It's 5 years later. The tall trees, these are banana trees. There's quite a few different vining beans. They also grow a lot of squash in the shade. There's vanilla vines. They've got passion fruit. They've got guava, tea tree, black pepper tree. Just a wide diversity of plants. Macadamias. Have you ever seen macadamia nuts? This system behaves differently than the bare dirt sand where they started from. Jackfruit, it's the world's largest fruit. You'll get like fruit this big, 35, 40 pounds. It'll feed a family for half a week. It's a weird kind of thing. It's like these little seed pods that all stack together. It's all soft and juicy and sweet. You pull it off and eat its seeds at all. So it's actually incredibly delicious fruit, fairly high in protein. There's breadfruits, jackfruits, there's coffee, this is cocoa, all growing in their system where they had nothing before, nothing but sand, and then, of course, bananas. We can know the succession of a place. This landscape-scale cereal grain ecosystem, it has a particular disturbance regime. Every single spring or every single fall, if it's a winter wheat, the ground is prepared with an herbicide, so any living thing is killed. Then we plant the wheat, and then X months later, we harvest the wheat and repeat the process over and over and over and over again. Biodiversity goes down to one. The opportunities for people to actually live here, fall away to almost nothing. There's no way for humans to make a livelihood, hardly any wildlife. This is a depauperate system, and the food, if you call it food coming off of here, it's empty carbohydrate filler that barely keeps you alive. The disturbance regime of this system and its ecological effects are radically different than a wheat and bean rotation alley crop with walnut. Here's the same thing. We're still growing large-scale annual grains. However, we have another element involved here. We're doing a crop rotation, wheat, beans, wheat 1 year, beans 1 year, wheat 1 year, beans 1 year. Then we have a woody component where we have walnuts growing in there. While the walnuts are maturing, blowing off of the wheat, and within 10, 15 years, we start to have nuts off of this for sale to nurseries or for eating. And long-term, we have timber. We now have a almost infinitely incalculable, more diverse system than this, different disturbance regime. And this is different than the restoration agriculture process. What we have in this photograph are three different layers of clover, a white clover, which grows close to the ground, a red clover in the middle, and a yellow sweet clover, which will eventually overtop the rye. This is not wheat, but rye. All right now, when it's ready, it can be harvested however we choose to harvest it, and then the clover grows up tall, and when it casts seed, we either roll it, mash it, trample graze it, by accumulating extra organic matter. That's what those practices are doing. They're accumulating extra organic matter. We have extra carbon in the soil, which is the energy. It's the fuel that runs the whole soil food web, which makes things grow better in the future. So we start a regenerative process in the direction of succession. We also have planted here a whole host of woody species based on what the woody species were and have been historically in this area, the ones that will grow most likely to grow and succeed with sheer total utter neglect. We arrange them according to the pattern of water management distribution, and we actually plant them and maintain them and sometimes harvest the consumer. Now, this apple orchard produces a lot of apples. It has a different disturbance regime and different ecological effects. What I'm trying to do here with these different systems is to show you that this is different than this is different than this. What this third picture has right here is way more biology going on. This system is full of life. This is full of wheat. The wheat growing in the ground is only alive because it's kept alive with chemical fertilizers. This is a very input-intensive system. It depends on cash to be able to buy the inputs that you need. The availability of the inputs, which are mostly mined substances transported over long distances. This is an expensive, very fragile system. You have a hiccup in the fuel supply that runs these tractors and combines, that whole place shuts down. That's a different system, radically different system than this one. You could all of a sudden have the same fuel system shut down and you don't have as many grains, but you have another thing to rely on. We've got the walnuts as a backup. Or maybe this is small enough we can actually do our small grains with hand tools. This system right here, there have been years that I've done zero annual crops at all because I couldn't afford to, and we just kicked back and harvested the yields off the perennial crops. It's a radically different system, different amount of inputs, zero pest control inputs in this system for the past 21 years. No fertility inputs other than a few mineral amendments here and there banded right in the row with the crop that we're growing in question. Same thing with these trees. These are perennial crops. This is good. If we're going to start eating more permaculturally, we've got to eat more perennial foods. I would rather see you eat perennials that were grown this way than wheat and corn, because it's just a little bit more alive. We have grass growing, which means we probably have some underground critters and fungus. There is organic matter in the soil here. And we've got trees, we've got fruit, and so we probably also have pests and diseases up here. There's a lot more life here, but there's still an input-based, very fragile system that is dependent on toxic chemicals to keep it going. Has a different disturbance regime and ecological effects than this one. This is at my farm. What's really fascinating about this, looks like I'm getting plenty of yields here, not just apples. The yields start in the spring with cyanwood that's cut and sold for other people to graft from specialty, rare, and odd varieties, cut flowers, and honey, comfrey root and tops, iris roots. Of course, then there's cattle and hogs and fruit. But in this picture, we didn't have the cattle in here yet. Plenty of grass, bees, honey. Now look at the difference here, where now that the cattle are introduced into the system, they've pruned the branches right up. These are snub-nosed, hornless cattle. Actually, these are pigs, obviously. They're cleaning up the windfall apples after we've already picked the low-hanging fruit that's looking good. What's the difference between this one and the last one? This one has a lot of low branches to the ground, and this is a very humid. You see it's shady here, a lot more humid. A lot more fungal disease is going to get established in here, and then a spore.
All right. So I paused the video once again, Wayne. So, yeah.
Hey, all right. Well, hey, everybody. Thank you for being patient. I am out in the field, and a huge rain, thunder, lightning, all kinds of bad things. Weather storm came up earlier, quite a bit earlier. Mark, when did I texted you and said I would probably be late, you know, maybe an hour or so before, and it continued. It was about an hour and a half long storm. Right. Not a lot of rain or anything, but just miserable. And didn't have any signal at that point. So anyway, I wasn't able to be at the start. So this is a great replay from Mark, defining, the Mark Shepherd sort of way, permaculture. And I was enjoying it myself. We're going to be doing a lot with Mark's videos, the ones that, I don't know if many of you realize this, but Mark did over 200 hours of sessions with us. Now, probably a third of those were question and answer, really. But we're going to take the time. We're going to edit them. We're going to get them into a status that they really, fit together well. And then we're going to make them all available for you guys. So It's going to take some work, but we'll get that done. Anyway, the guy is just so right on as it relates to agriculture and permaculture, and just living. So anyway, miss having him around. You know, that was a very cool period of a couple years where we spent a lot of time together, did a lot of projects and other things together. So anyway, I saw a few comments and questions. How is Webinar Jam working for those of you that are on with us today as a platform compared to others? I saw Robert said that when he had the phone in the he's on, it must be on his Android, that he wasn't able to see the chat. I'm on an iPhone here today, and my chat is below the screen where the replay would be or where my image is right now. And so it's there. It's just, it's not in, it's not next to it like it would be. When I turn my phone to where it's sideways, or, you know, where it's the length of it facing out to the side, then the chat actually goes still below it. It doesn't go to the side. So that's just the way it orients. So, Mark, you must still have the replay picture up there. Because on my phone, I'm just seeing my image being really little down in the corner. Is that right? I was just trying to, we don't need to have it any different.
Yeah, that's correct. So if you want, I can stop.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
We're getting 10 minutes left to the top of the hour anyway. I did see a couple of comments in there from Alicia. What's interesting is I pulled up the one of the other icons here, Mark, and I can't get back to where the comments are. Let me see. Oh, there they are. I got it.
Yeah.
Hey, Corey. I see Corey's out there. Robert, Alicia, just the ones that are putting comments in. Robert asks Alicia, are you planting any interesting fruit? I've been saving all the apple and pear seeds for winter pie making. I hope they'll grow. They'll be growing in the garden for a few years and make good rootstock in a few years, and some good tree hay for animal forages too when they're growing, which is what they will do. What else do we see here? Well, actually, Robert, it was more than the 43 weeks was just what he did in forest ecology. He did questions and answers. When you put it all together, there were over 100 sessions. And the reason I said 200 hours is because he would often go for 2 hours. It's not at all uncommon, and went longer than that sometimes.
Right.
So. Robert says, learning to adapt to the real. Everything seems to be continually developing. It's nice to become familiar with current limitations. So we're about ready to do some really cool things with the thousands of hours that we have of presentations. We've already started, but again, we're going to put them together in smaller pieces. That's what people want to see now. We've already started writing a couple of new books. Actually, not just started. We have 3 new books, don't we, Mark, that are almost ready for us to publish. Yeah. One of them on cattails and emergent vegetation and what the value of it is. A second one on did we do it specifically on algal blooms because of the problems that we had throughout the country last year with them?
Duckweed. So,
duckweed. Oh, well, no, not duckweed. Duckweed's a really good plant for aquatic situations, but blue-green algae are very, very negative. So we put some together. We have one on juicing that we're pretty proud of. That's really nice. And we redid our backyard aquaculture book.
Right.
And what else, Mark? We had one more that we're working on.
We did a flip book version of the aquaculture book.
Right.
And then the I think the duckweed, the cattail, and juicing. I'm not remembering what the fourth book was, but I think those are the ones.
We did something on algal blooms rather than just. And I think you're right. I think we did something on duckweed specifically. So that's the four.
Yeah.
I think it's blue green algae, duckweed, cattails, juicing. Those are the ones.
Yeah.
And again,
right.
Those are my expertise, everybody. That's why we chose those. I know those aren't going to be the most popular for everybody out there because not everybody's into aquatic stuff. So, and we'll write others where we need other experts, people from the from our community, to step up and help us only to the extent that they would be experts in helping us decide what content that we would be using. So it's really easy to do something with Mark's stuff, but a lot of work. And
yeah,
we could also use some help even on the work side as we get moving ahead here to help us with editing or putting together images and all kinds of things of that nature. So, but we want to, and we'll be making those available to the community, but then we'll be hopefully using them for what we call funnel magnets for new people, because we do give away a book now. And Mark, I bet we're up to 5,000 copies of it we've given away, called Unleash the Entrepreneur Within You.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Some of you are here today because you got that book.
And, right.
And that one, we've never sold that. We've always given it away.
Yep, it's the most downloaded book on our website.
Yeah. And by the way, it's well done. We didn't do all the writing. We had a lot of help with that one. So, but it's really good for those of you that are right now working for somebody else, and you'd really rather not. You'd rather be out on your own. Robert says that Mark, and this is Shepherd, I think, it could have been you, Mark.
Mm.
Mark from Bangladesh. Maybe he means you, Mark. He was the inspiration for planting apple seeds. I actually think that's probably
Mark. No, yes. That's Mark Shepherd.
And then Robert, gosh, did you sell the apple seedlings for $150? Or were you talking about some that Mark sold? Shepherd said it was inspiring. It's a pretty cool icon you put right behind the inspiring. Where'd you get that one? That looked like some kind of an emoji, but I can't tell what it is.
Yeah,
There's some cool emojis in here that must be available on our chat that are kind of cool.
Right. These are built in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we are getting close to the top of the hour. Any other questions from anybody? Comments?
So another, I see a bunch of people saying Android here, all good. Okay. So yeah, but a lot of people with mobile phones. Corey is on Android.
Robert said that that Mark Shepherd offered the bare root apple seedlings from his place.
Okay. All right. And then Robert was having problem earlier with his phone, but I think it's working now. And Alicia has a link here, Forest Lair. I think she had a question about food forest somewhere here.
I don't see it. I was looking through the question.
Yeah, I think if you join later, you don't see the chat that's been, you know, that she's been putting.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's interesting. That's right. Not good. So there's chat that comes that if you come in later, you don't see the chat.
Yeah, that already been put in.
Yeah. Everybody, by the way, when we edit these and we put them up as replays, Mark does put the chat role in. So yeah, you can get all the chat from most webinars we've ever done. It isn't just what's on. You can get the chat also.
Mm-hmm.
If you attended and you want to get that, you can get it.
Yeah, here's a question she has about food forest layers. So tall tree or canopy layer, what is the largest overreaching layer of a food forest? And then it's a pretty long question. It's composed of trees that are typically around 9 meters, 30 feet, higher, more when fully mature. And then sub canopy or large shrub layer. How big can a layer? Ground cover layer.
Underground. Yeah, she's going down in the layers that there'd be in a
forest. Okay, so yeah. All right. So these are I think she's describing various different kind of layers. All right.
Cool.
So what are the question is, what are the layers of? I think she pretty much.
Well, she pretty much she listed them there.
Right. So. Yeah. Yep. Those are all all there. So before that, I don't see any other questions here.
Okay. So, since our last webinar, since last Thursday, which last Thursday I was actually right in the same area when we did this, but I was done with other things I was doing. I'm in Emmett, Idaho. Look that up on a map sometime. Beautiful little town, 20,000 people or so, just a gorgeous place, mountains around it. Last night snowed in the mountains, so you can see the snow, but it's not on the ground down here. It actually probably didn't get much below 40 degrees last night, very warm for this time of the year when it can still get below freezing. But anyway, I'm here at Emmett, and I lost my train of thought as I was talking about Emmett. Why did I even bring that up? Just that there's since last week, when I did the webinar here, we have now controlling the property that I was describing that is going to be our new Mountain Sky Ranch property. So this will be a different name. It's on a place called Black's Creek, and we're actually looking for the name for it. We think it's either going to be Black Creek Sanctuary, something like that. And we want to use the name Black's Creek because everybody in the region knows where that is. So it gives a good description of the location. It's 2,000 acres, which, remember, in Colorado, we had 160. So this is quite a bit bigger. It's got every kind of ecosystem on it that you can imagine other than dense forest. We don't have dense forest, but we have creek bottoms and mountainsides and hillsides and lava rock areas and outcroppings and streams, ponds, no lakes really, but about a 10-acre pond that will be improving. We're going to develop it into an eco-living, an ecological or an economic living park. So there will be lots that will be selling and available, and there'll be food production going on. There'll be all kinds of recreation circumstances. We'll be looking for partners to do ecological businesses, economic businesses, make some money making the planet better. So a lot of you should be thinking about that. Pretty nice part of the world to be living in. Fairly mild weather. We get winter, but get some snow, but never really enough that you have to worry about shoveling it or plowing it. It doesn't get that much even, but it's beautiful and mild in the summers, not that warm. It's not humid, so the warmth doesn't seem so abrupt. But we're now controlling that. We'll be developing that now in the near future. So we'll talk more about that, and we'll actually do some webinars from there. The cell phone signal out there is excellent, actually. So anyway, we are at the top of the hour. Unless there are any other questions, Mark, let's take a break. Yeah, stun, Robert put in. If everybody remembers what that means, strikingly terrific, utter neglect. That's the way that Mark Shepherd and a lot of us farm, which means you should do whatever you can do to let the plants and the animals grow they would without you having to do anything. Now, that's impossible to do it completely that far, but strikingly terrific, utter neglect is the way that we think is the best way to farm if you can do it.
Yeah. He mentioned that today also in this presentation. But, yep. If you want to wrap up this session, then we can play this whole video tomorrow on the.
Why don't you? Because that's a great video.
Right.
Oh, the acreage is in Idaho near Boise, Robert, and it is a possible partnership, and it isn't just 10 acres. You know, we're going to at the very most develop. There'll be buildings on the very most 50 acres of the 2,000 that we have. The rest of that 2,000 is going to be used for ecological purposes, either maintaining the natural terrain or enhancing it, berming and swaling it, putting key line sort of water collection systems, all kinds of things that are regenerative in nature. So anyway, that is in Idaho. I will say this, because I know he's on here. I'm having some good discussions with another one of our members who has got a place in another part of the country that over time we'll talk about, but it's one that he wants to partner in, and he wants to be developing it just like we would want it done in a regenerative space. So we'll be working together with him on that. We have our place in Colorado still that we're still maintaining. And then I have talked about our place that we're working on down in Texas. So I'm getting a few of these going around the country, but we need a lot more around the world. Really, we need them around the world. So, all right. Well, let's, unless we see anything else here, maybe we should call it a day. Oh, Alicia said, what's the cost per acre? What are we buying it for, Alicia? Or what are we going to be selling it for? We're not going to really probably be selling much. We're going to be partnering on what we have. And the places that we'll sell will be where specifically improvements will occur. So buildings will be built. And, you know, it'll be whatever the market price is here in this part of the world. It'll be fair pricing and reasonable and maybe a little less expensive. But we're going to encourage partnership. Which would be where we'll provide the land for people for the kinds of things that they want to be doing. And Corey says, Iowa next. Again, I didn't mention Iowa, Corey, because I hadn't gotten your approval to say that, but that is the land that I'm talking about, because Corey and I have had a discussion, and we're going to do it more about how we take the gorgeous property he's got that he's now owns, as well as other acreage that he has some quote control over, and turn that into regenerative living and have places for other people to live and all kinds of just, again, great and exciting stuff. Kenya is lovely this time of the year. Maybe John Liu has more details. Well, John's a good friend of ours. And we had John on, what, about 2 years ago, Mark? No, it wasn't even that long. A year and a half ago, probably. And we'll get him on again. He's always available. Right.
Yeah. I think we did one recently, right? Pretty recently.
Maybe it was less than a year. Yeah
maybe a year. Right. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, John's done some awesome stuff and continues to. So, all right. Well, Mark, I don't see anything else here. Let's. And Corey says he wants to do more. We're going to help him do that with his property, and all you in the community can be thinking about how you could be helping too. We should all be thinking about that and helping each other. Wow! All of a sudden, that picture's huge, Mark.
Yeah, I blew it up. Yes. You guys stop the video and that blows up your picture.
So I've got on, I'll go down here. That says Idaho. Right?
Yes.
That's where I went to college, University of Idaho. Went to a couple of years of my school there. All right. Well, we'll call it for the day. Thanks, everybody. You guys are all awesome. Mark, you have a great day. We'll be doing a replay again tomorrow.
Right.
Obviously, you can go on the site anytime you want. You guys are all members. Look at stuff. Comment on stuff. Offer suggestions on stuff. Let us help you build businesses. That's what we're all trying to do here, help each other. Thanks,
all
everybody.
Right.
Take us out.
Hey, everybody. I bet you enjoyed that immensely. That was one of our most amazing presentations here at the EAT community. Please look forward to our next podcast in the very near future, and we look forward to seeing you again on the EAT Community Podcast.